Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I don't think it's going to change very much. Looks to me like the best we can hope for in 2024 would be to sort of hold stable.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
Stop liquidating, so stop getting smaller. That's good. And in fact, that's not uncommon. If you look at cattle cycles historically, they kind of have a flat spot on the bottom. They typically have a flat bottom there where there'll be 2 years that aren't very much different, and then you start regrowing. But the way I look at it, this time, 2024, flat to, and depending on what drought does, could continue liquidation, but the best we could hope for would be flat. Limited potential to growth and to grow in 2025. So I think we're talking about an extended process before we could really ramp up to a faster pace of expansion.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm going to talk first about the federal budget and then discuss the economy.
Dr. Philip Schwagel is director of the Congressional Budget Office.
So in the projections we released today, the deficit grows from $1.6 trillion in 2024 to $2.6 trillion in 2034. Measured in relation to the economic output, deficits during that period are about 50% larger than their historical average over the past 50 years. Net interest costs are a major contributor to the deficit, and their growth is equal to about three-quarters of the increase in the deficit from 2024 to 2034. Initially, net interest costs are similar to the amount of discretionary spending, both for defense and for non-defense activities. By the end of the period, at $1.6 trillion, interest outlays are roughly 1.5 times larger than either defense or non-defense spending. Also boosting deficits are two underlying trends: the aging of the population and growth in federal health spending per beneficiary. Those trends put upward pressure on mandatory spending. Measured in relation to economic output, federal debt held by the public rises from 99% in 2024 to 116% in 2034, surpassing its historical peak. Then the debt ratio continues to rise, reaching 172% by 2054. From 2024 to 2033, the deficit is about 7% smaller than we projected last year, primarily as a result of the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023 and the subsequent continuing resolutions. Together, those laws reduce the growth of discretionary spending. Including the effects on debt service, legislative changes reduce deficits by $2.6 trillion over the next 10 years. In our projections, the deficit is also smaller than it was last year because economic output is greater, partly as a result of more people working. The labor force in 2033 is larger by 5.2 million people, mostly because of higher net immigration. More workers mean more output, and that in turn leads to additional tax revenue. As a result of those changes in the labor force, we estimate that from 2023 to 2034, GDP will be greater by about $7 trillion, and revenues will be greater by about $1 trillion than they would have been otherwise. We are continuing to assess the implications of immigration for revenues and spending. And in particular, we are still analyzing the immigration legislation that's been considered in the Senate. Two key factors partially offset that deficit reduction relative to last year's projections. The first is that net interest costs rise as a result of higher interest rates. And second, the cost of energy-related tax provisions are much higher than the staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation originally projected. Those costs reflect new emission standards, market developments, and actions taken by the administration to implement the tax provisions.
And economic projections?
The U.S. economy grew faster in 2023 than it did in 2022, even as inflation slowed. Economic growth is projected to slow in 2024 amidst increased unemployment and lower inflation. CBO expects the Federal Reserve to respond by reducing interest rates starting in the middle of the calendar year. In our projections, economic growth rebounds in 2025 and then moderates in later years. Since February 2023, when CBO published its last full economic forecast, the agency has lowered its projections of economic growth and inflation as measured by the PCE price index for 2024.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
U.S. domestic supply-demand balance sheet had just little change. There was a cutback of about 10 million bushels usage for food use, and USDA indicated that for the October-December quarter, that's the lowest amount of flour usage on record.
Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien. Guy Allen is senior economist with the IGP Institute.
That low use of flour production is just, I think, indicative of what's happening in demand, not only here in the U.S., but particularly in the West.
O'Brien says it all starts with the WASDE, or World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report.
It was interesting where it came from. The cutbacks that the USDA did were in hard red spring wheat, you know, again, higher protein wheat, and soft red winter, which is, you know, that has certain types of products that work well for that class, a little bit in white wheat. There's another change although the total export number didn't decline from the 725 million that the USDA had been projecting coming out of January. We did see an exchange of 5 million bushels lower, down to 140 for hard red, what we grow in the plains, and an increase of 5 million up in the hard red spring wheat area. So that just continues the trend of challenging hard red winter wheat exports. And when we get talking about international trade, what's coming out of the Black Sea region, particularly Ukraine and Russia, both have a strong competitive impact working against U.S. wheat exports, as well as currency issues, which we're going to talk about later. So,
could demand be hurt by changes in diet?
The big issue is that dietarily, we're struggling on the demand base still quite a bit. You know, it's not falling off, but it's sideways to lower. And you look at the overall move, we did raise with those changes, did raise ending stocks about 10 million bushels, up 658, and stocks to use now is 35.2% to 35.21, and that's back up to where we were basically 2 years ago. Price two years ago was 763. This year it's 720. USDA projection.
And what about internationally? Alan explains.
Well, on the international side for wheat, the bottom line, let's start at the end and then work backwards. The world stocks to use come down 32.5% compared to a bit higher than that in January, but 34.5% a year ago. And I think that's just indicative of the situation. Even though it's tightening up, though, it's still a very comfortable situation. We continue to see prices lag. Nobody seems to be too worried about it. Digging into the demand side, China imports were lowered 500,000 tons. Keep in mind, though, that total Chinese consumption is the second highest on record, projected by the USDA, with the food sector at a record 116.5 million metric tons. So we continue to see good demand in the wheat situation in China, and you've got to believe that's going to help that import number for China. Looking at the production side, Russia forecast unchanged, 91 million metric tons with 51 million metric tons of export. Both of those the highest levels ever. Ukraine production at 23.5, unchanged. Exports were up 1 million tons at 15. Sort of a real change year to year was the Australia crop left unchanged at 25.5, but that's compared to 40.6 compared to last year, a record crop. So that gives us some hope we can compete there in the Southeast Asian market a bit more competitively this coming year. Canada unchanged at just under 32 million metric tons. EU at 134. Exports unchanged at 51. So, look, there's plenty of alternative sources of wheat out there, and we're seeing a fiercely competitive market in that export.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So my grandfather actually founded the breed. It was developed in the early 1930s, and I'm the fourth generation. My son is the fifth to continue raising beef pastures. And so during those years, which is going on 90 now, the breed has developed and changed along the way, but I think it's the seventh or eighth largest breed in the U.S. in registrations today, and so we've really grown, largest of the American breeds, and we're real proud of that.
Lorenzo Lassiter with Beefmasters. What are the six keys to success?
So as my grandfather developed the breed, he developed a philosophy also called the Lassiter philosophy of the six essentials. And those traits are fertility, weight, conformation, hardiness, disposition, and milk production. And his idea was that if you select cattle for only those six economic traits in balance to the exclusion of everything else, you will have financially rewarding, productive, and fertile cattle. And so that's been our trademark throughout, and that's one of the reasons the breed has stayed balanced and stayed true to its roots and hadn't chased a lot of fads through the years, as a lot of breeds have gone through over the years. And so the cattle continue to be productive ranch-type cattle today as they were back in the 30s.
Dr. Joe Mask is Executive Vice President of Beefmasters on using the information.
As we're staying true to those six essentials that Mr. Laster came up with, but we're also now trying to enhance them. So we're doing a lot more work with feed efficiency, a lot more work in carcass quality, because the Beefmaster female, you can't beat her. She is the best female out there. She's the one that gets the job done. But how do we affect the crossbreeding systems of today, and how do our bulls work on other breeds of cattle? And so we've got some really good data that's coming in on carcass quality now. We're using a Laster bull to get some of that data as well. And we're looking at that feed efficiency, looking at those cattle that grade. And over the last 2 years, our cattle have graded choice or better when they've been bred to English-type cattle. So we want to continue that, continue the research, and making sure that we stay true to the six essentials, keep the maternal cow at the forefront, but then make sure that our bulls have a place in the industry.
Looking geographically, where will you find the Beefmasters breed?
Well, you know, most of the Beefmaster cattle are in the southeast, in the southern states, in Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas. But, you know, we've got cattle in Oregon. We've got cattle spread out in Tennessee, up in the Carolinas. And we know, Tony, that the climate's getting hotter. We know that. We can see the change. And these eared cattle, you know, have the heat tolerance, they have the heterosis, that they can go out and survive about wherever you put them at. And so they can take the cold weather, they can take the heat, and they can also take that, rainforest type of situations in other countries as well.
Dr. Lance Bauer is Director of Breed Improvement with Beefmasters on EPDs.
So as a breed, to echo everything that Lorenzo and Joe have said, all these economically relevant traits, that's what we're pushing for. We've got EPDs that measure these traits just as the other breeds do. We're continuing to expand on our research to move the breed forward, to strengthen these EPDs, and to create some new EPDs that'll focus on the maternal ability of these cattle, the sustainability of these cattle. You know, sustainability is the big keyword. And that's what we're looking for, is a sustainable animal. And I'm not talking sustainable just as in feed efficiency, but sustainable as in she's going to have a calf every year. Sustainable in it, she's going to be feed efficient, but also sustainable in the feed yard. And I think we've seen that. We're developing tools to help select for those traits and continuing to strengthen what we already have.
But where would you find more information on Beefmaster online?
Sure, Tony. You can go to beefmasters.org, find all the information about the association, or call us there in Bryan, Texas. We're more than welcome to, you know, any calls, any type of questions. We'll be able to help you answer them.
Lorenzo Lassiter, Dr. Joe Mask, and Dr. Lance Bauer with Beefmasters. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We are continuing a campaign that we've been running for a couple of years now called Fairness for Farmers.
National Farmers Union looking for swift completion of Packers and Stockyards Act rulemaking. Rob LaRue, President, NFU.
And it's absolutely about making sure that there are fair rules in place for livestock markets. On top of that, making sure that we get truly right to repair for ag equipment owners. And then on top of that, making sure that we can make sure that whether you're a livestock producer or a row crop producer or producing fruits and vegetables, that the marketplace is truly open, transparent, and fair. So there's a lot of moving pieces. Some of those we're looking to put into a farm bill here as front and center. But as you said, we're also working with USDA on the rulemaking that they have going forward right now. I tell you, pandemic is getting a little bit in the rear view. But we can still remember the pain of the disruption and what I think a lot of consumers knew for the first time that farmers have known for a long time, and that is that we in many parts of agriculture have such a concentrated marketplace that when there was a disruption like a few packers, for example, in the beef industry, you have a shrinking cash market. When you have a big disruption, that ends up hurting two groups of folks, that is the consumers on the one end with higher prices and producers on the other getting caught. I tell you, we have a long way to go to bring true fairness into this marketplace, but Farmers Union's been in this fight for a long time. We're certainly hopeful that USDA is going to finish some of these important rules on Packers and Stockyards Act. That's a law that farmers fought 100 years ago to be put in place, and it really helped for a long time. Now, some of those protections have kind of eroded in recent years, and it's time to bring some teeth back into it for the sake of livestock producers.
But he says Farmers Union gets their marching orders from members.
We have a couple more states to go with our state conventions. Texas recently had theirs. Oklahoma convention is coming up soon. But our national convention is right around the corner in Scottsdale, Arizona. And, you know, a number of issues that we've already talked about, things like Farm Bill, things like fairness for farmers issues, whether it's right to repair or trying to get a handle on antitrust laws and the monopolization of agriculture, and certainly making sure that we have stronger protections in place for livestock producers. All of those things I talked about, and I tell you, I don't want to overstate this, but these conventions, whether at the state level or even like your local county meetings, I don't care what organization or you're in, but certainly at Farmers Union, it's important to be involved. If you're a producer out there, either raising crops or livestock, you've got to say that's really important to try to get up through the process here, both in terms of the organization itself, but certainly to our leaders. And I tell you, I worry a little bit with a lot of the dysfunction in I think folks generally across the board in the public are kind of stepping back from being engaged, and they are becoming really cynical about kind of our process. That's a little worrying, and I want to make sure that certainly for farmers and ranchers that they remain engaged, and we are seeing growth within Farmers Union, and we're certainly seeing a lot of activity at these state conventions. So hopefully Rural America's strong voice is going to continue out there, and we can get some things done.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The only change that was on non-ethanol food seed ingester usage, it moved down by about 10 million bushels, and total use down 10, ending stocks up 10, so really pretty much unchanged, up from 14.8 to 14.9% stocks to use.
Dan O'Brien is a grain marketing economist at Kansas State.
Big issue in the corn market is this 14.8, 14.9% stocks to use is markedly higher, way more plentiful as a projection than what we had the last 2 years at 9.2% stocks to use to 9.9. So we jumped to almost 5%, and the market is just not worried about supplies. It's become a buyer's market right now.
Looking at the global situation, Guy Allen, senior economist from the IGP Institute.
I guess the biggest contentious issue on the global situation is, we'll start with Brazil. USDA reduced that crop by 3 million metric tons to 124. CONAB, I don't have those numbers right off in front of me. Dan,
CONAB,
if you could help me out.
CONAG came out this week, just right before the USDA report, said 149.4. So it's a major difference you're talking about corn, right?
Correct.
100, just under 114 million. So there's about a 10 million metric ton difference that has to be reconciled. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle, but at this point, it's a point of uncertainty going forward in the market.
Yeah, that 10 million ton discrepancy is quite material in there, and we'll see a similar situation when we get to soybeans. Exports were increased slightly by 2 million tons to 23, so again, plenty of corn hanging around there. We're also seeing other suppliers unchanged, such as Argentina, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, et cetera. On the demand side, this is where I sort of maybe have a different opinion of USDA. China still has strong demand in the corn side as well as the soybean side, and I can't help think but suggest that the Chinese demand is a bit overstated. I think they're looking at unchanged, but imports expected to be at 23 million metric tons this year. That corn and soybean number for China, I think, is going to move together because it's being driven by basically the pig numbers.
And Brazil, cheaper grain than we have right now. So if China has a choice to go to Brazil for any of these crops, they're doing it each time out. It's a preference to the political currencies, whole bunch of reasons probably, but that they are going that way.
What about sorghum?
Well, sorghum is probably one of the brighter pictures, I think, across the whole commodity complex, being driven mainly by exports and demand from China. Surprise, surprise. Exports were raised 10 million bushels to 240 million, and they basically took that number off the domestic number and tightening up the ending stocks a little bit. I guess they're showing them unchanged from February. So we should expect to see fairly good premiums domestically out there going forward.
So they took the USDA in that sorghum supply demand balance sheet added 10 million bushels to up to 240 million of exports of grain sorghum, took it off of food seed industrial usage. So if you look out here in the country, in Kansas anyway, you know, we're in the eastern two-thirds of Kansas, we're 20, 30, at times 40 cents higher cash prices. So it makes sense in our neck of the woods where we grow a lot of sorghum that if you're going to put the grain into an ethanol plant, gosh, corn's cheaper, you know, than sorghum right now. So that makes sense. And the pace of exports, it's not consistent, but we've had several weeks where if we need a pace of 4 million tons a week to meet the USDA's projection, then we'll get 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, some, and a lot of it's going, again, Guy, you used to be in China or stationed there, goes to domestic beverage consumption, doesn't it?
Yeah, biggest demand point of that's for the baijiu, which is a grain alcohol they sell as a health food. I think it cures the COVID.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So I am a fourth-generation commercial cow-calf producer. Again, we've been doing it for 125 years. We got our Centennial Ranch designation a few years ago. I'll talk about cows all day. I'll talk about tech all day. And if I get to talk about both of them, we might be here for a week.
Mark Tague is from Washington, Oklahoma, and is a founder of AgBoost. What is it?
So AgBoost, the best way to describe it, Tony, is we are a data analysis and data visualization platform. So what that means, I can take data from anywhere, genomic tests, EPDs, phenotypic scores, udder scores, foot claw angle, whatever you want. I can take it, put it into my system, and render you a visual that makes sense. So essentially, Tony, what I say is my biggest competition is Excel. But if I show you an Excel spreadsheet with 1,000 rows and 1,000 columns and I ask you how many times does the number 5 occur in that spreadsheet, you can't do it. With my software, not only can you tell how many times the number 5 occurred, but who it occurred and how many times it occurred on them. So I make your data collection and data visual easy. That's essentially what we do.
So let's dive deeper. What is DNA testing? What can we pull from this?
DNA testing has gotten really, really efficient, and the prices have come down dramatically as it increases. But essentially what you do is you can take a DNA sample from an animal. It's a blood card, a semen, that could be an ear punch. We take that data, bring it to us, and we don't care which lab it comes from, or you can send it to whatever lab you wish, or we'll send it to whatever lab you wish. We take the data back. Once we get all those back, whatever that trait, whatever the number of traits that test brings back, is that's what we visualize. So you have things like Cavanese Direct, milk, birth weight, et cetera, right? A lot of things you see in EPDs, it's the same thing in the genomic testing.
Obviously, we can take EPDs and use that to improve the herd, but can we do that as well with genetics?
The more genomic technologies we use, the better it gets. The accuracy just continues to go up. Now, I will tell you, you know, there's no such thing as a plug-and-play cattle business. It just doesn't exist, right? So really, in my estimation, what genomic testing tells you, it will actually reaffirm what you probably already know about your cattle. If you've lived with them long enough and you're a good cattleman, you know what you got, right? But being able to transmit that or communicate that to someone else or communicating the value is hard to do if you just sit down and talk to somebody. Hey, they look great out in the pasture, but how do they perform, right? Or how what's their potential to perform? And that's really what we're measuring with genomic technology, is just that potential to perform in the offspring.
We're really staring at the smallest herd in history. So can we use this to rebuild?
This is the absolute best time to do it, because the biggest bang you'll get from it for genomic testing is replacement heifers. Because essentially what you're going to end up doing is, if you test your replacement heifers, you don't have to test all your cows. If you've lived with them long enough, you know what you got. But if you test your replacement heifers to make sure you're putting the right maternal genetics into your herd and what you want to build, it's going to make you that much more efficient, and you're going to be right more than you're going to be wrong. So let's face it. So when we look at replacement heifers, you've got a couple of years worth of non-productive time. You've got money invested in the development of that heifer. Usually numbers say about $2,000. And if she falls out of your program, you're not getting $2,000 back. You're not making your money back on that. Now, if I can provide you some insight into that, and again, I'm not right 100% of the time, but I'm right 80 plus percent of the time, But if I can give you that insight and you're right more than you're wrong, you're going to make more money by selecting the right replacement female. So right now, especially because we're going to have to replace the herd, now is the time to do it.
Mark Tague with AgBoost, ag-boost.com. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As beef production falls in the U.S., and particularly as cull cow slaughter drops, when we don't have to liquidate and try not to cull as many cows, that's one of the bases for stopping liquidation, then our processing beef that supports our ground beef market that's so important in the U.S., and so that becomes much more attractive. Prices are higher, so we start importing more beef.
Oklahoma State livestock economist Dr. Darrell Peel.
I think it'll probably continue as we go forward. It doesn't change. I mean, none of those are, they're at the margin. So none of those are changes that overwhelm or offset what's going to happen in the U.S. industry. But they modify it a little bit around the edges in terms of, you know, and it really comes down to how much our consumers impacted. If we import a little more beef, then there's a little bit less pain for consumers with reduced beef production in the U.S.